We're on a highway to climate hell, with our foot still on the accelerator. The message set out at the start of COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh from UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres couldn't be clearer. Since then, we've had discussions, big announcements and negotiations to the wire, because our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. I'm Georgie Frost, and welcome to the So What from BCG, as we reflect on COP27, the hopes and expectations, the successes and disappointments. So what would be the legacy from Egypt?
So it will be clearly remembered as the first COP where loss and damage was agreed. This will be the biggest single legacy of COP27. To a lesser degree, for progress on adaptation, progress on food and agriculture. And this will be remembered also as the COP where the just transition has been high on the agenda.
We've been looking at the solutions and the economic opportunities that climate action presents. Go to our YouTube channel to watch dozens of our interviews from COP27. But first, let me take you back to the start of the conference. Head of BCG Africa, Patrick Dupuy, welcome. So here we are, Patrick, in the BCG studios in the heart of the Blue Zone where negotiations are taking place. Just tell me, if you would, your impressions for anyone who's, and probably most people listening, will have never been to an event like this. This is certainly my first time. Not your first time, though.
Actually, yes, it's my third COP. I attended the last Africa COP in Marrakech, Morocco, in 2016. And I attended Glasgow last year. Well, this one is, I would say, a bit different. The sense of urgency has increased. Just this year, there's been like horrible weather events. In Mozambique, hurricane destroyed full infrastructure in the central part of the country. In East Africa, we have terrible droughts, which impacts food security and agriculture. And in the country where I spent most of the last 13 years, Morocco, we had our first water restrictions for ages. So the reality of climate change is really big in Africa. I think it's not only Africa. I think we saw Pakistan this year, but also Europe. So it seems to me that compared to the other COPs, the sense of urgency of the situation is now very broadly shared by all participants. And you feel that in the discussions, in the conversations. Then for the rest is the same frenziness. You know, you walk, there are like dozens of pavilions, lots of discussions, high-level discussions with heads of state and the room full of ministers and so on. And then smaller discussions where you have more people on the scene and the panel than people actually listening. But that's the variety of the COP, and that makes it both exciting and a bit tiring, I need to say.
I was going to say, overwhelming was something that sort of struck me. I mean, it reminds me of a bit of a cross between a travel expo and a party political conference. Noise, loads of different languages, amazing dresses, just everything going on. But what of all of that noise are the key issues that are particularly for Africa coming out on the centre stage, out in the global media? What are the key issues?
Yeah, so the last Africa COP, COP22 in Marrakech, we had actually worked with the Moroccan presidency. It was the first time BCG was involved in COP. And at the time, we had raised the attention of the Moroccan presidency on what we called the AAA gap. Three areas where climate discussions were not spending sufficient time and where climate finance was not spending sufficient money. The first one, the first A, was adaptation, getting prepared for the world that we will have to live in tomorrow. Then the second A was agriculture. It was 4% of climate fundings, despite the fact that agriculture was 25% of emissions and would be the sector which would be most impacted by climate change. And the third A was simply Africa. You know, Africa was receiving only 4% of climate funding, was not part of most of the discussion, despite the fact that 35 of the 50 most impacted countries in the world by climate change are in Africa. So now, a few years later, these are three topics that are central to this COP. And we are already seeing that it's actually growing in terms of funding and in terms of attention.
Another big topic on the agenda was loss and damage. Who would pay for the destructive impacts of climate change that can't be avoided either by mitigation or adaptation, impacts of which disproportionately affect developing nations?
We are seeing visible impact of climate change. In some countries, it can impact GDP by 5-10% GDP. We did a study in Lagos. 3 million inhabitants of Lagos will need to be either protected or displaced. It could impact the GDP by way over 10%. So African countries are saying, listen, we have not caused this climate change. We need to be compensated. We need also to have a funding mechanism to repair when disasters are occurring. So loss and damage will be a priority topic. And the good news of the first day of COP, is that there's been an agreement for the first time to put loss and damage formally in the agenda of COP27. Another new topic, which is growing, it's just transition. It's not only about reducing emissions in Africa, it's how do we give energy access, in particular electricity, to 600 million Africans who do not have access to electricity today. So it's nice to come and say, listen, you have not emitted nothing, you have emitted nothing, but on top of that, you know, you cannot increase your energy production. We need to help them provide and deliver a low-carbon energy system that gives access to these millions of Africans who do not have electricity today. And I would say the last topic, which is probably the most important in this COP, is climate finance. To deliver all this agenda, adaptation, food and agriculture, Africa, loss and damage, just transition, we need money. There will probably be discussions around reforming the overall global financial model, and we believe this is going to be hopefully a big outcome of this COP27.
Are you hopeful about the outcomes of this COP for Africa? Is there a sense among countries on this continent that perhaps the world hasn't been listening, hasn't paid enough attention to Africa, that they've been sidelined?
I don't think you need to get a sense. You just need to look at the numbers. And Africa is still only getting a very small numbers of climate funding. We promised, the North promised $100 billion a year by 2020. We are in 2022. We may hardly get to 70 to 80. And the share of that going to adaptation, which is probably the biggest claim of African countries, is still way too low. So it's not only about filling outside the main conversation, is just like looking at the numbers, follow the money. The money is not there. So yes, African countries feel that they are suffering from something they have not caused, but they are not really given sufficient attention.
COP gave me the opportunity to speak directly to those people on the ground in the countries most affected by climate change. Tolu Oiken, head of BCG Nigeria, explained why climate adaptation is so important for Africa and African cities, and how hopeful he was to achieve it.
We need to focus even more on cities, because with the increase in urbanization, cities is where have the bulk of people today, and we expect to have even more people over time. So we need to focus on building resilience in Africa, in African cities today. One of the challenges we all need to grapple with is the fact that we live in a world of finite resources, and nowhere is that more evident than in Africa, where we need to develop, where we need to develop and build human capital with limited resources. And so I think the first thing we must do is ensure that we have a deep understanding of the risks that apply to us on a local level, because we need to tailor our solutions to those risks. So the first thing we must do is build understanding of the risks. With a deep understanding of the risks, we need to build a clear portfolio of projects that are tailored to that risk. And then we need to galvanize stakeholders to drive financing towards those projects. We see in our work three types of projects that we need in Africa. I think one is we need to build resilient infrastructure. You have coastal cities that have their power lines on the coast but are going to experience sea level rise. You have buildings that are not appropriately weatherized. The first thing we must do is build resilient infrastructure. In addition to building resilient infrastructure, we need to build resilient communities. There are individuals that are going to experience seawall and flooding right now that we need to consider relocating. We need to ensure that people have insurance to absorb the shocks of these climate impacts. And as government and as city planners and country planners, we need to also improve our ability to assess the risks, anticipate the risk, and respond when this climate impacts realize and arrive.
There was much talk too about the economic benefits of the transition to the green economy, collaboration between the private and public sectors, and what solutions are being implemented. BCG's Vice Chair of Social Impact, Climate and Sustainability, Wendy Woods, told me how technology can contribute to adaptation and mitigation solutions.
So technology is a fundamental and a critical enabler to actually making progress on any of this. One of the examples, we're working with many clients using AI to help understand how to be much more efficient in everything they're doing. Less electricity, less materials. And then on the adaptation front, technology enables you to see so much more. Right? The geospatial analysis that we can do at massive scale, but at a level of detail, allows the kind of planning that we need to do for adaptation. So technology is fundamental to making progress on both of those.
To change it, you need to be able to measure it. And that, unfortunately, is one of the problems with companies. They have the goals, they have the ambitions, but tracking emissions is a very difficult process. So how can technology help here? And also more generally companies to achieve their climate goals?
Well, technology enables you to measure things right now and understanding your baseline in the first place and then understanding what actions you can take to actually change and improve on that baseline become incredibly important. One of our tools, CO2.ai, is doing that with clients in understanding and measuring the baseline, finding actions, and then enabling that progress. That becomes incredibly important. The other thing I would say, technology provides so many nudges for all of us all day. And when we think about the behavioral side of what we all need to do differently on climate, the nudges that technology provide us in the right direction on what we can do to support climate become very important.
It's important to remember not to leave people behind in the move to a green economy. So there was a lot of emphasis on a just transition, making sure the benefits are shared widely and those who stand to lose out economically are supported. One group that is already being disproportionately affected is women. I spoke to Zineb Squali, managing partner at BCG Casablanca. Zineb is very active on the topic of women's empowerment in Morocco and Africa.
We now have evidence that women will be disproportionately impacted because they tend to be more vulnerable, poorer, so they are less equipped to deal with climate change. There are three numbers that tell the story quite well. Number one is 80% of the people that were displaced by climate disasters in 2015 were women. 12 million girls are at risk of school dropouts each year. So 12 million girls each year. Why is that? Because when these climate disasters happen, we realize that families actually favor boys to stay at school rather than their girls. And then the third number is 60% of sub-Saharan women work in agriculture, and we know how much agriculture is going to be disrupted. So actually, climate change will have a higher burden on women when it comes to their health, their education, their income level, even their own survival is more at risk.
You've spoken about climate change disproportionately affecting women, but also climate action as well. Through your work, you found that it sets back gender equity by 15 to 20 years. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, this is counterintuitive, right? Because climate action, that's all the efforts we're making to build a better planet for everyone. So obviously, women as well as men, even more than men in some aspects, will benefit from living in a more sustainable planet. But what our research has found out is that women might also be at risk of missing out on the green economy's massive investments and job opportunities, or at least at some of them. Jobs, for example. We know that the green economy will be creating 65 million green jobs by 2030. These jobs, the highest paid, the more stable ones, require what we call STEM education. That's science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And women today only represent 35% of STEM students globally. So they are clearly at risk of missing out on these opportunities. Second example, companies in highly emitting sectors such as energy, building materials, industrial goods will be spending as much as $500 billion by 2030 to upskill their employees. The problem is these industries are male-dominated, historically male-dominated. So mechanically, women are less likely to benefit from these retrainings, again, widening the skill gap between men and women. And then entrepreneurship. We know that female entrepreneurs get less access to funding than male entrepreneurs. So there are already a few, say, clues to the fact that if we do not do it right, climate action could also be widening the gap between men and women. And this is, of course, not the intention.
After the elongated negotiations were finally wrapped up, I caught up with Patrick Depou again to get his reflections on COP27. So I'm back with Patrick Depou. I'm in London. You, Patrick, are in Johannesburg. The weather is distinctly less sunny where I am than it was in Sharm. But what about the negotiations? Were they warm? They went on after we left, didn't they, into the weekend? What was the mood? What was discussed? What was agreed?
Friday for us was our last day. But I would say that it's really where the action started for them. When it's tough negotiations, it's always being completed a couple of days. So they reached an agreement on during the night of Saturday to Sunday. Clearly, the biggest outcome is loss and damage. You know, that has been a long claim from the global south. And up until now, most countries in the north did not want to accept any mechanism for loss and damage because it has some implications on potential liabilities and so on. So it was a no-go. In Glasgow, it was mentioned that we could start thinking about it, but it was not a done deal. And I think the key outcome of COP27, there is now an agreement to create a fund, an agreement that loss and damage is a reality, is part of the discussion, that there will be some fundings. And it's a huge victory for the South. And I think it will also bring back some sort of trust in the climate negotiation cycle from the global south, who have seen that the north has not lived its promises of the 100 billions from Paris and Copenhagen, who were starting to doubt the fairness of the overall process, and at least their voice has been heard, and this one is the biggest one. Then there are a number of things in the final declaration. Nothing to really get enthusiastic about. Mm. The good news is that the 1.5 is alive, but the truth is that there has not been a commitment to update, national determined contributions, so the emission reduction targets every year. And so that has been a disappointment to some. But at least we didn't go back on this 1.5 target. And adaptation resilience, there has been an agreement to create a work group on the doubling of adaptation finance. So that's good. But I would say loss and damage is the key achievement of COP27.
So Patrick, finally, what are the next steps then? What are your hopes between now and when we next talk? Hopefully we talk before that, Patrick, but in Dubai for COP28, but also the next time it comes to Africa in 5 years' time. What are you hoping we'll achieve and what are the next steps to get there?
Well, first of all, we need to be realistic. Emission reduction targets are nowhere near what we need. We are really far off. Some complain that there were no more pledges. The truth is, it's not so much pledges that we need, it's action. It's, it's to make sure that these pledges are sustained, because right now, this is not the case. So when current pledges go for minus 30, minus 25 reduction by 2 or 30 of the emissions. And of course, we need minus 40. But the reality is the current policies go towards plus 10. So the top priority is to live our promises, to achieve our pledges, and to accelerate, because we are way too slow. There is some momentum. We are, in a way, reassured that it was not like broken up during this year of conflicts and crisis, but it's still way too slow. So what can we hope in the next months? Acceleration, more projects, more funding, more actions in the north, in the south, more of everything, making sure that the US-China relationship on climate is not impacted by the overall tension between the two giants. Because we will not achieve anything if China and the US and even India are not actively collaborating. So there are some technical things we are expecting, which is, how do we implement what has been agreed on COP27, during COP27 on loss and damage and many others. But what we need to see is more action on the ground from the private sector, from the public sector. We need to see massive acceleration, because the truth is we are on the highway to hell, and we are, I'm not sure we are accelerating, but we should have the feet on the brake, and we don't have that.
Patrick, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you for listening. That's it from COP27. We'd love to know your thoughts. To get in contact, leave us a message at thesowhat@bcg.com. And if you like this podcast, why not hit subscribe and leave a rating wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.